Good evening. You're listening to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. My name is Trevor Harris. Each week, my colleague Darren Helwidge and I take a look at a person, place, or phenomena that makes Mid-Missouri unique. My first guest this week is Columbia author Joanne Trogdon. She recently published a book, The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
For many people listening, William Clark is a name from their history books that they might have studied in grammar school or high school, and they know him as one of those guys that made the big trip west through the Corps of Discovery in 1804. Can you give us a little background about William Clark and what led up to the very specific era in which you wrote in this book?
Yes, I'd be glad to. William Clark was the youngest of five brothers, three of whom were still alive in 1798. One of them was George Rogers Clark, who had been a general in the American Revolution and a hero, but through really no fault of his own, he had gone almost bankrupt. So he needed financial help. Well, as the youngest son in the family, it fell to William to help keep the family farm going. It was a plantation near Louisville, Kentucky. But like his elder brothers, William had joined the army. So in 1792, after serving in the Kentucky militia for a couple of years, he joined the U.S. Army, and he stayed in the army until 1796. He was a lieutenant. During that time, though, he stayed a lieutenant, and he really was not able to distinguish himself. He was in the Battle of Fallen Timbers, which was a battle with the Indians north of the Ohio River. It was a skirmish for territory. Of course, the United States Army won. But that was really William's only combat experience during his 4-year stint in the Army. He resigned in 1796 because, you know, his rank had not increased, and he compared himself, I'm sure, unfavorably with his elder brothers, all of whom had become high-ranking officers. So he returned home, and then he had to help the family, especially in light of the financial problems of Brother George.
You sort of addressed this in the answer to that last question. Can you talk a little bit about the time in which William Clark was traveling along the Ohio and the Mississippi rivers and after he'd come out of his military service? What was the culture like then?
Well, William had been interested in making a trip down the Ohio and the Mississippi rivers at least, I think, since 1794. So by 1798, he had been planning for a long time and looking for an opportunity to try his hand at commerce in Spanish New Orleans. Now, we have to remember that the Louisiana Purchase was not to occur for more than 5 years from really the beginning of my book, which is set in 1798. So he had an opportunity after he had resigned from the army. And in March of 1798, well, the ice on the Ohio River had thawed, so he was ready to go. Culture, though, was this. In the United States, especially what was then the Western United States, Kentucky in particular, was filling with settlers, and there was quite a market for manufactured goods and for things that could not come, that Kentuckians could not grow themselves. Some of those things were sugar, coffee, and as I said, manufactured goods. The problem with getting such things from the Eastern United States was carting them across the mountains because, of course, there were the Appalachians between the eastern seaboard and Kentucky. So freight coming that way was just too expensive. It was less expensive coming up the Mississippi and the Ohio rivers. And even though this was way before the day of steamboats, there was some commerce. So Kentuckians wanted to trade with Spanish New Orleans, not only to get the trade goods that Kentuckians wanted, but especially to sell the things that they grew. Kentuckians were interested in selling at New Orleans their products, which were mostly tobacco and cured meat, pork, and then furs, many different kind of furred animals along the rivers up north. And William Clark had wanted to engage in this trade for years. Finally, he had an opportunity. So in March of 1798, He had a couple of used flatboats, which he had purchased and had repaired them. He bought extra planks, he caulked them, and then on March 9th, he and a crew of seven other men that he had hired shoved off from near Louisville, Kentucky, and set off down the Ohio River, heading for Spanish New Orleans.
So one of the ways that we know about this trip and what transpired on this trip is a journal that you came across housed at our own State Historical Society of Missouri on the University of Missouri campus. Could you talk about your discovery of that journal and what the journal revealed about Clark's trip and what it didn't reveal?
Yes, I'd be happy to. My discovery of the journal came about quite by accident. I had just finished a book about the history of St. Charles, Missouri, my hometown. And that book is entitled St. Charles Borromeo, 200 Years of Faith. It's a bicentennial history of the first Catholic parish. Many of the earliest records of St. Charles are in parish archives. So I had used these archives and had come up with a lot of information about St. Charles. I had also used Spanish archives because St. Charles then was part of the Spanish government because it was west of the Mississippi. After I had finished my book about St. Charles, I was looking for information to answer a question having to do with the signature of a man named William Clark, which appeared four times in these parish archives. I had no idea whether that signature was the signature of the well-known, the man who would become known as an explorer. But that signature appeared during the years 1798 to 1801, and I had to find that out. So I went to the University of Missouri at St. Louis Library looking for a biography of the famous explorer William Clark, and it was 12 years before there was any biography. I wasn't able to find out anything, but I did find a reference to this 1798 to 1801 journal of the famous William Clark, which was in the State Historical Society Library, in Ellis Library here in Columbia. At the time, I lived in the St. Louis area, but I was able to borrow a microfilm copy. And that's how I found it. My impression when I first saw it was I was able to determine that it was a different William Clark whose name had appeared in the St. Charles archives. And I really wasn't too surprised about that. But the story that this journal, the 1798 to 1801 journal of the William Clark, told was fascinating. My first impression of it is that it told a fascinating story about how William Clark, in 5 years, would become Meriwether Lewis's first choice to help lead the expedition to the Pacific Ocean. And the story is that William Clark left home in March of 1798 with a couple of flatboats of goods to sell in Spanish New Orleans. And on further research, I found that Meriwether Lewis, unlike William Clark, had, number one, never been on a western river. In fact, he'd never even seen the Mississippi River. Number two, he had very little, if any, command experience. But here was Clark with two flatboats and then seven and sometimes eight crewmen under his direction. And sometimes these crewmen liked to, in the evening, they'd pull over and they'd all drink. So they'd get drunk, and then he had discipline problems he had to deal with. Well, Lewis didn't have those sorts of duties during his stint in the Army. And Lewis had never been in foreign territory either. So this journal of Clark told about him spending weeks, months even, in Spanish territory.
You're listening to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. My name is Trevor Harris. I am honored to have in studio this week Joanne Trogdon, the Columbia author, has recently published via the University of Missouri Press The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark. I asked Trogdon to talk to me about what she thinks William Clark might have gotten caught up in Spanish New Orleans on his trip down the Mississippi River in 1798.
In Clark's own journal, he wrote the names of two people with whom he dealt. And those names I found in Spanish archives, and I was surprised and even shocked to find out in reading further in Spanish archives that these individuals, number one was Judge Benjamin Sebastian of the Kentucky Court of Appeals, who lived in Louisville very close to the Clarks. In fact, he was a very close friend of William Clark's father. He was one, and he was secretly in the pay of Spain. He was involved in the Spanish conspiracy. The other person that Clark named in the journal who was also involved in the Spanish conspiracy and was indeed in New Orleans when William Clark was in 1798 was an accomplice of Sebastian. His name was Samuel Montgomery Brown. He had his own boat. I think it was a keel boat because he was able to take it upriver. But Clark collaborated with them and wrote in his journal about smuggling money, Spanish silver dollars, pieces of eight, they were called, but they were coveted in the United States because the United States, especially the western part, that is Kentucky, was cash poor. The U.S. did not mint much money then, and there was no paper money. People in the United States got by mainly on IOUs and drafts and that sort of thing. But when they could, they spent silver, and Spanish silver was really what they wanted. The Spanish conspiracy was a series of plots that began by the General James Wilkinson of the U.S. Army. In fact, he was commander-in-chief of the U.S. Army. He had commanded William Clark during Clark's first stint in the Army, too, and Clark looked up to him very much. But Wilkinson was a traitor to the United States, and in 1787, I believe, even without a passport, Wilkinson, who had quite a winning personality, took a trip, a commercial trip, down the Mississippi River to Spanish New Orleans and brought along gifts enough to bribe the Spanish officials in New Orleans, so that then he told them that, well, he was very well connected, which he was, but for the right price, he would become allegiant to Spain. And he did. While he was there, he dealt with the Spanish, and they promised him, I think they lent him several thousand dollars, which turned out to be a gift because he never paid it back. But he took an oath of allegiance to Spain then. A few years later, then that's what he became, a paid spy. And he was on the Spanish payroll. Oh, I think in 1798 he was making $2,000 a year, which was a vast amount of money.
You said earlier that your motivation for what ultimately became your new book, The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark, came from a journal that you found at the State Historical Society of Missouri. William Clark kept this journal for a period around when he made this trip in 1798. What does the journal talk about?
Most of the journal concerns his trip in 1798. The journal is 88 pages long. 77 of them concern what he did in 1798. And of the rest, of three or four pages of a little trip he made in 1801. But my interest when I first found the book was just what Clark did, heading down the river and then what he did at New Orleans. The problem, though, was there are two sections to the journal about 1798. First are his diary entries, Clark's diary. And then the second part, 30 pages maybe, concern a ledger that he kept. Well, here was my problem. There's a gripping story about Clark's trip down the rivers and then in Spanish New Orleans. If this was a business trip, though, then where were the business records? When Clark reached Spanish New Orleans, he almost stopped writing in his diary. And his ledger didn't have much to say either. So I'm really not sure, based on Clark's records, how much money he made from his cargoes. But what happened with the ledger, once he got to New Orleans, he began writing about, very frankly, about such things as bribery. In fact, he even spelled it out. He talked of the Spanish inspectors who were in charge of his tobacco and his furs and the cured pork he brought to sell. Once he reached Spanish New Orleans, those things were inspected, and he would have to pay a duty, like an import tax, in order to sell them. But rather than writing about the duty he paid, the total amount, according to Spanish records, was $17.32. That's what he would owe. But Clark then began writing about, I gave the inspectors of at the customs house 4 hams, or I gave them wine. And then he said he paid maybe $2 or $3 of the duty. But he never wrote in his diary about, or in his journal, about paying that whole duty. I checked the Spanish records, and they don't say that he paid it either. I think what he was doing, and as he spelled out in his journal, was that he gave them what he called a bribe, a bribe.
We have an image of the persona of William Clark. If you know much about the Corps of Discovery, you know that he did a lot of documentation on that trip. He was a hero. He helped us understand better what we had just purchased as the United States. Your book sort of chips away at the facade of that hero. It paints him as a more complicated individual than we may have thought him to be originally. You don't come out and say in the book, William Clark was guilty of treason and guilty of conspiring with Spanish agents to undermine the United States in Kentucky. It seems like your new book does a lot to further color the personality of William mm-hmm. Clark.
Yes, and he does deserve fame and honor for his role as an explorer, and subsequently his various roles in federal government, in St. Louis especially. But he was a complex person, and that's my goal in The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark, to show that, yes, he was complicated, and he had motivations, as everyone else does. But he was not a simple person. I think Lewis and Clark scholarship has compared him with Meriwether Lewis, who is acknowledged as quite a complex individual. It was Lewis who died at the age of 35, probably by his own hand. But Clark was a very complex individual, too.
That was Columbia author Joanne Trogdon talking about her new book, The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark, published by the University of Missouri Press.